Welcome to the Unfiltered Podcast with me, Joe Warner, and powered by Ultimate Performance, the world's premier personal training experience that delivers maximum results in minimum time. In each episode of the Unfiltered Podcast, I interview the most respected, celebrated, and controversial experts in the fields of health, fitness, nutrition, well-being, and performance to help you find the life-changing advice you need to live smarter. Remember, you can find all of our exclusive Unfiltered documentaries, video interviews, and investigations at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. And now, on with the show. The public perception of life extension research, it varies dramatically, but you've spoken at length before about the almost urgent need to have the public on the side in terms of this research. How do you feel that we're doing in terms of better communicating the upside of the research that you're involved in and alleviating some of the concerns that people might have about this type of research?
Well, this particular topic is, I would go so far as to say, unique among topics where experts need to communicate with the wider world. But what makes it unique is that there is what I've called the pro-aging trance, this desperation by the overwhelming majority of the general public to put aging out of their minds because they know that it's a ghastly thing. They know that we have failed ever since the dawn of civilization to do anything about it. Therefore, they are terrified of getting their hopes up, despite the increasingly forceful testimony from people like myself to the effect that we are within striking distance of doing so. And honestly, you know, that's understandable, because pioneering technology always has an extremely uncertain time frame for fruition. And you know, I could be wrong, as far as they're concerned anyway. And it's not just me, of course, it's also other people. But that means that the communication, as we would normally understand it in other areas, is not really the problem. There's plenty of communication. You know, I spend my life on stage and on camera, I'm not the only one, and I've been doing so for the past 20 years or nearly that. Interest for information about this is insatiable. It's just that the only way that it can be disseminated is, you know, through the media and so on, is by kind of watering it down and essentially, you know, presenting it as something that people can keep their emotional distance from. Now, the question then is, how can we change that? And honestly, the only way is to make progress, to actually make incremental advances in the lab and in the clinic that show that we really are getting very much closer to this. That is not something that the public is in a position to understand directly, because it's, you know, it's hard science, it's technical. But what they can do is, you know, get a feel for the extent to which the expert community is becoming more optimistic in its public pronouncements. And so I say that's where we're at right now. We need to have many more public pronouncements by experts. You know, for the longest time, it was just me out there, you know, saying, you know, we're getting close. And, you know, I was able to, now that resonated with some people, but only some people. Now we've got a much greater diversity of advocacy, you know, forms of words, different people with different styles of communication. And we've also got experts doing the same thing. We've got more and more people coming out. I often mention probably the other really most prominent expert in the field, David Sinclair, because he and I have been close friends for 20 years. You know, he's no less courageous than me. But it took him, I'm going to say, 11 more years than me to come out with a general audience book that says we're in striking distance of fixing aging. You know, my book came out in 2007, his came out in 2018. And the fundamental reason is because he has the misfortune to be a professor at Harvard, which means that, you know, if he'd brought out a book with a title like, you know, Why We Age and Why We Don't Need To, in 2007... he wouldn't be a professor at Harvard anymore. Whereas now, he can get away with it.
I think it's been brought into the
public consciousness, this type of research recently with the number of tech billionaires investing in Silicon Valley startups. And I'm really keen to get your views on whether or not this has been helpful to the conversation around longevity research. It's very easy for the mainstream media to twist this into some kind of rich man seeks living forever technology that doesn't really resonate with the average guy or woman on the street. Do you think it's been helpful in that, in the conversation, that this money, at least money, is being spent on research now that maybe wouldn't have been?
Absolutely. So, I mean, you're quite right. It is typically somewhat twisted, and people try to make this, you know, sound as though it's not such a good thing as it actually is. But it's definitely a very good thing. It's a better thing in some cases than in others. So, for example, when Larry Page and Sergey Brin put a large amount of money into this new thing called Calico, which is quite some time ago now, getting on for 10 years, you know, I was quite hopeful because they had been familiar with this field and had met me and talked to me and so on for some years before then. But it's a complete fiasco. It's a complete waste of money because they set it up. They just mismanaged it. They hired the wrong people at the top. I mean, some of the right people, but not all the necessary right people. And it'll be a complete piece of luck if they ever produce anything of any originality. Whereas Jeff Bezos has now come in, of course, and put proper money into this new company called Altos Labs. Sam Altman has put money into Retro. These are companies that are, well, they have a much better chance, especially Retro, which is headed by a lifelong longevity crusader and is not going to waste the money. So, you know, it's definitely going to help. However, this infusion of money, I have to emphasize, is very unevenly distributed. It is mostly going from people who are not just believe in capitalism, but actually don't believe in anything else. I'm no enemy of capitalism, but these are people who basically don't believe in nonprofits making any real progress in pioneering technology. And that means that the money is being very, very strongly biased in favor of the low-hanging fruit, the areas of rejuvenation biotechnology that are relatively straightforward to implement. I emphasize the word relatively, but still. Whereas there are other areas which are just as vital, without which we simply will not see the full benefits of all this work, and which are just harder and are pre-investable, and therefore are in need of purely philanthropic support. So that is why I still run a non-profit, and that's going to be true for the foreseeable future, because so much is needing to be done that can only be funded that way.
Did you feel a sense of frustration then, that the low-hanging fruit, as you say, is being targeted, where, yes, you might see some results, some benefits, some trickle down there into actual life-extending strategies, but you sound as though we're missing the much bigger picture, and we're not shooting for the moon here. And that sounds like, in your view, it's a mistake.
It's certainly a mistake. You know, frustration. Well, you know, if I were the kind of person who would be ground down by frustration, then I wouldn't have got this far, right? but yeah, I mean, it is frustrating. Absolutely. I constantly have conversations with high net worth individuals who are in a position to help substantially. And of course, the grassroots donations that we receive are also extremely important. I mean, the faster we get money in the door, the faster progress will be made, the more lives will be saved, the more suffering will be alleviated. So yes, it's vital to get the word out more and more.
How big an issue is the public perception of aging in terms of people, I think, just kind of accept, as you said, they kind of put their head in the sand. They don't want to think about it. It's an inevitable part of life. You get older, you become less able to do things, and ultimately you die. Where you've spoken before as aging being something you manage, like a car is the example you give. It needs to be maintained. The accumulated damage, if it can be removed, means you can extend the lifespan dramatically. Is there still a big public awareness here of what aging actually is? Because I think people have almost put it into a pigeonhole of you age, you die, and that's the end of the matter.
Yeah, I mean, there is, to my mind, a very strong sense of thing of what I'm saying going in one ear and out the other. Because, of course, you know, I've been saying all of these things in very high-profile fora across the world, You know, whether it's print media, whether it's TV, whether it's, you know, TED. I spoke at TED 17 years ago, you know. So, you know, these things are out there, and they've been, you know, most people have been exposed to them one way or another, but you wouldn't know it to talk to them. So I think it's just, it's part of putting it out of their mind is just not letting themselves actually absorb the kind of message that's out there in the media from people like myself.
But are you noticing a nudging of the needle? Are you seeing things in terms of understanding moving the direction in which you were hoping for? How quickly or how slowly is it happening based on what you would like?
It's happening at every level, but it's happening far too slowly. So, for example, when I talk about low-hanging fruit, obviously it's not just like two sets of things, the investable and the uninvestable. There's a spectrum. And a few things are gradually, you know, kicking and screaming, being moved into the investable category. This kind of started happening about 6-7 years ago when a few people who were very much investors rather than donors started getting involved. They were, the kind of people who, first of all, they did understand the humanitarian value of this mission, and so they did donate a bit as well, but they were very much keener to write much bigger checks to companies. So we actually at Sense Research Foundation adopted a business model where we would spin projects out as startup companies as soon as investors could be interested in them. And that definitely did help somewhat. But, you know, it's now at least 7 years since that started happening. And we're only just now getting to the point where one of those projects that were spun out is now being sold to Big Pharma. You know, it's like, it's unbelievably painfully slow.
Is there anything that can be done to speed up that process, or is that just the way of the world?
Well, I mean, the way I see it is it's not, it's an accelerating process. So as there's a big like positive feedback loop here that the more people come out who are whose publicly stated views are respected, the more other people will feel that it's safe to come out and say the same thing, even though they've been thinking it for a long time. So, yeah, I mean, I think we are definitely seeing that acceleration now, but I would definitely like to see more of it.
What are the biggest obstacles to seeing some of the breakthroughs of which you've spoken about for the last 15, 20 years? We've spoken about public awareness, funding, legislation, technology, cross-discipline collaboration. Is there one blocker that you're most concerned about, or is it a combination of factors?
Yeah, it's definitely the combination. It's this kind of, you know, web of inertia that, you know, it's a bit of a prisoner's dilemma, really, that, you know, each individual constituency, whether it's a scientist or government or the media or whatever, they've all got to look after their own interests, and being the, you know, the squeaky wheel that moves out and actually starts being more aggressive is a very difficult thing for most of those, for any of those constituencies to do. So it has to be done in unison.
Do you feel there's a lack of vision or a lack of ambition? Obviously, you've been someone pushing this for so long now. There doesn't seem to be many other people like you. Are you concerned by just a general lack of ambition in what could be such a seismic project?
Well, yes, but that's kind of human nature. You know, I mean, most people are not comfortable with aiming high. They're not comfortable with, you know, taking a heretic's path in life the way I've definitely done with my eyes entirely open. I don't, like, blame people for that necessarily. You know, most people, as I say, are caught up in the system, even if they look as though they are in a position to do what they like. You know, being a professor at Harvard has its downside, is the example I just gave, right? And that applies to virtually everybody in the field. So again, you know, it's all a kind of herd mentality thing. There is more and more going on that is, you know, conversations behind the scenes which are increasingly leading to more and more aggressive and optimistic public statements. But it takes so, so long. And it happened even within the field. So, for example, my whole idea of classifying the various types of damage that accumulate in aging into this manageable number of categories, you know, that was from the year 2000. The first paper came out in 2002. It took another 11 years before the mainstream got sufficiently felt sufficiently safe to be able to you know, come out and say the same thing in these various, you know, upstart versions of the same thing, like the hallmarks of aging and so on. Now, it didn't take 11 years for them to understand what I was saying. It did take maybe, you know, 5 years, but only about five, right? And so the rest of the time was just the dust settling and the, you know, and people becoming sufficiently comfortable that they were not going to be pilloried for saying things that were wrong or that were unpopular.
Of the seven types of aging damage that you've identified, would you be able to just give us an update into which one or which couple of those areas are showing the most encouraging signs of a breakthrough?
Yeah. So this again comes back to what I was saying about the spectrum of difficulty and, you know, which things are low hanging, which ones are not. And I don't want to say that the ones that are most impressive and interesting are the ones that have gone furthest, because they were already furthest, you know, 20 years ago, like stem cell therapy. What I would like to highlight is the fact that everything's made progress now. So, even the most difficult ones, if you'd asked me this same question maybe 6 or 8 years ago, I would have had to confess that two, at least, I'm going to say two of the seven categories, had made no concrete progress. They'd made, like, you know, tentative progress, but it was fragmentary. It wasn't really adding up to anything. Now, that's not true. Every single one of these areas has now led to at least one or two companies being formed. In other words, investors are getting involved, so it must be, you know, close to making money out of. On top of that, you know, the kind of, you know, canonical slide that I use, the table I use to describe this in most of my talks, I deliberately put one up that essentially describes the situation 20 years ago, just in order to emphasize that, you know, I've been making a real nuisance of myself for a long time and challenging my colleagues to come up with anything that doesn't fit into this classification. I'm still getting away with it. But a thing I also have started to highlight more is that now, in contrast to that table where I just listed one generic damage repair approach for each category, now there's at least one more on top of those ones. So we've got options. And of course, it doesn't matter which one works.
And in terms of the next step, what is going to be the next evolution of changes that you're hoping to see or developments? Is there one particular area in which you're, I don't want to say pinning your hopes, but most enthusiastic or most encouraged by?
No, actually, it's rather the other way around. Because the damage repair approach is necessarily a divide and conquer approach, the thing that I am, well, betting on, I'll say, rather than pinning my hopes on, is that we will be able to see really dramatic impact by combining individual things that each individually have only a modest impact. And of course, that brings me to the main activity, the flagship activity of my new foundation, LEV Foundation, which is the combining at the moment of four different interventions, each of which have shown very significant promise. We're talking here mice, of course, not humans, because we only do early stage work. But these four interventions all have great promise when applied late in life or in middle age. So typically about 18, 20 months of age. So they've never been done in combination, and we're doing that. It's a really ambitious, audacious experiment. It's a lot of money. It's costing $3 million and change. But it started a couple of months ago, and you know, we'll be finished for 3 years. But we will very much expect that by the end of this year, we will see, you know, we will have a good idea about what's working and what isn't. Of course, we're not just looking at longevity. We're looking at all of the measures of health at a given age that one typically does in these experiments. So it's an extremely ambitious and audacious piece of work, but it's got to be done. Nobody else is doing it. The work that other people are doing is kind of edging in that direction, but it's almost entirely restricted to things that you can supply in the mouse's food, which means you're excluding stem cell therapies. You're excluding gene therapies. And we can't do that. Because those are the things that are really going to change stuff. So we need to be doing this same experiment over and over again with different combinations of interventions, and it's $3 million a pop. So I'm constantly out there beating the bushes trying to accumulate that money so that we can get the next one going as soon as possible.
I was hoping you could explain the concept of methuselarity, and forgive me if I've not pronounced that right, but from my understanding of your concept, it's that the technologies are going to be there to allow humans to survive until the next generation of technologies come through. Firstly, have I understood that right? And could you tell us a little bit more about the concept and what it's going to mean for us all?
You have understood it correctly, and you also pronounced it correctly. That is actually not my word. It was invented by a friend of mine. But basically, the Methuselarity is the point at which we reach something that is my word, the thing called longevity escape velocity. So that is exactly what you said. At the moment, we are building up the components of a comprehensive panel of interventions that has the potential to give us substantially greater healthy lifespan and thus, as a side effect, substantially greater total lifespan. And the question is, you know, when is that going to see significant output, significant readout in terms of actual extension? We don't know. But we do know that eventually we'll get to a point where it'll be, let's say, 20 years of additional healthy life. And, you know, I think at the moment that we have at least a 50-50 chance of getting to that point within the next 12 to 15 years. So not very far away. Now, the best thing of all is that this healthy life extension will be given to people who are already in middle age at that time, just like our mice that we're working on right now. So that means if you're, let's say, you know, 45 or 50 now, then you've got a very respectable chance of benefiting from these therapies. So then, coming back to longevity escape velocity, the question is what will happen if you've got these therapies at, let's say, age 60, and they've knocked back, they've eliminated some, not all, but some of the damage that you're accumulating, so that you don't get to be biologically 60 again until you're 80, right? The question then is, what will happen? Of course, you can apply the therapies over and over again, but the therapies will not work so well as over time because the body will become increasingly full of damage that, for whatever reason, the therapies do not succeed in removing. And so, you know, that's not going to help. You're going to get old and sick anyway. However, because that 20 years is, you know, time that we have bought for people like myself to continue improving the therapies, what I just said isn't going to be the case at all. What's going to happen instead is that the 80-year-old who is biologically 60 for the second time will come in and we will be able to re-rejuvenate them just as well as the first time. So they will get another 20 or 30 years and before they get to be biologically 60 the third time, and so on. That's longevity escape velocity, and the Methuselarity is the point at which we reach longevity escape velocity, because we're definitely, once we get there, we're definitely never going to fall back below it.
And you think we're going to have a 50-50 chance of reaching this point within the next 12 years?
What 12 to 15. 12 what, to 15, I'd say, yeah.
I mean, that's half a generation, if that, before reaching a point where most people watching this won't even be able to comprehend what that's going to mean for them. What makes you so confident that, given, you know, where you've come from over the last 20 years, that within the next, you know, 15 or 20 years, we're going to be there?
Well, first of all, remember that I'm not all that confident. That's why I always state things probabilistically.
But 50-50, I mean, it's the bottom of a coin.
But the point is, I think there's at least a 10% chance that we won't get there for 100 years, you know, if we just hit a whole bunch of unforeseen obstacles. So let's be clear about that. But then in terms of why I come to that 50-50 number, how I come to it, it's purely because I'm there at the coalface. I'm looking at the details of all the science that's being done, the rate of progress that's occurring, and I have a pretty good understanding, I think, of how much more there is to do that we can't yet do before we get this or that therapy to actually work. Now, a key thing that's very important here comes back to the main topic of what we were talking about 10 or 15 minutes ago, namely the public attitude to all of this. My belief is that the work we're doing with these combination mouse rejuvenation experiments is not only for the purpose of finding out what might work in humans. That's certainly important, but the additional, equally important purpose is to prove to the wider world that aging is amenable to medical control. At the moment, there is still this very strong prejudice that you've got the chronic diseases of old age, like Alzheimer's and almost all cancers and so on, which are, you know, nicely demonized. People think they're a bad thing. People think it's good to spend a whole bunch of taxpayers' money trying to cure them. And then you've got this other thing that's completely separate in people's mind called aging itself, which, you know, people don't even really quite want to believe is a bad thing. They try to pretend it's a blessing in disguise. And the only reason they manage to maintain that fictitious idea is that they've been able to carve off these aspects of aging and call them individual diseases, so that all that's left is this rather poorly defined nebulous thing like frailty, which is just as bad for you, just as fatal, right? It's just that we don't call it a disease.
You said in 2008 that the first human to live to 1,000 was probably already alive and probably in their 50s and 60s, if I'm correct. In the 15 years that has passed, are you more or less confident that that was the case? And I'd love to then get on to some of the implications for the individual, for the society, for the world at large, if that is the case.
Yeah, I think it's probably still the case. Maybe a few years of slippage has occurred, but only a few. Because, the age getting to 1,000 is, first of all, that's just an inevitable consequence of getting to the methuselarity. Because, that's the kind of age that people would, on average, get to if they maintained indefinitely the risk of death per year that young adults in the West currently have. So that even is a conservative estimate, of course, because it's ignoring the fact that we're going to have, self-driving cars that reduce road accidents and all the other things that reduce the risk of death from things that do not have to do with how long ago you were born. So that part, fine. And obviously, I've just said, 12 to 15 years until we reach that point, and your average person who's the age of 60 or 65 is going to be able to benefit. Now, remember my statement was about the first person to reach 1,000. And for that, we have to take into account the difference between biological and chronological age. Your typical person, there are a very small number, but non-zero number of people who naturally today reach the age of 110, which is like 30 years more than the average lifespan, right? Now, they don't get that way by aging normally and just managing to stay alive in an increasingly poor state of health. They get that way by being biologically unusually young throughout their lives. Your typical person who eventually gets to 110, when they were 65, they were biologically, 45 or something. And when they reached the age of 85 or 90, they were biologically 65. So that means that those people, who might have been 60 in 2008, will be biologically less than 65 in 15 years. Which is why they fit into the thing I was saying. If we talk about the age at which your average person's going to make the methuselarity, then it's about 30 years less, as I've just explained, but still.
You recently turned 60. Congratulations and belated happy birthday. How long are you going to live?
No idea. I don't think about that at all. I just get on with this. What gets me out of bed in the morning is not the possibility of benefiting myself from my own work. I mean, I know I may or may not, but I do know also that my work does not actually change my probability of making the methuselarity by more than a few percent at best. Whereas if I think in terms of the impact on humanity, then, every single day that my work brings forward the defeat of aging, I'm saving 100,000 lives plus, together with all the suffering that goes with the suffering of aging. So, that's very easy to get out of bed for.
There's obviously a huge amount of upside. You mentioned the number of people that could potentially be saved or lives could be extended. But with any strategy or any technology like this, how do we ensure that this isn't just the reserve of the rich, the elite who have the money? How do we ensure that this technology and the benefits trickle down to the poorest in society and we don't create a two or three tier system?
Yeah, this isn't going to be a trickle. And the reason it's not is because even in the case of governments that don't really care about doing the right thing or humanitarian imperative, and somehow or other they don't really care about the electoral imperative either, even if those things were the case, the sheer mercenary economic imperative is quite enough to make sure that governments will get this out to everybody, irrespective of ability to pay. Because the fact is, the situation we're in today, when we don't have these therapies, and therefore when people do get sick, and when they get old, it's unbelievably expensive. The vast majority of the medical budget of the Western world goes on the health problems of late life, which will be prevented. Now, of course, there will be some costs in delivering these therapies, but those costs will be massively less. These therapies, therefore, will pay for themselves many times over insanely quickly. So it just is inconceivable that any government, certainly any democratic government, but I would say any government, is going to not realize that by the time these therapies come along. Of course, conversations are already going on, and they're slow because governments tend to only think about getting re-elected, but we're getting there. We're getting to the point where governments are understanding what's likely to come, and of course they still don't know when it's likely to come, but they're going to be ready to ensure that sufficient investment is front-loaded to get these therapies out there to everybody who's old enough to need them pretty much as soon as they're available to anybody. So it won't be a trickle-down effect at all.
What about some of the other ethical considerations around population growth, allocation of resources, ecological impact? I mean, you're rolling your eyes. What should we be concerned about this? Or how do we factor in the inevitable vocal concerns that are going to be raised around these issues?
Well, of course, I'm rolling my eyes because I've been answering these questions for 20 years, and it's rather frustrating that the answers are not, that I keep having to carry on doing this. For each of these specific concerns that people have, there are perfectly good answers. Like, for example, people say, oh dear, where will we put all the people? And they just forget that the concept of having too many people now is not one of not having enough space. If every single person on the planet could have their own acre at this point, and we wouldn't even have to use places that are unpleasant to live. The problem is pollution, of course, and other technologies are coming along faster than anti-aging technologies that are going to fix that, whether it's carbon capture or artificial meat or cheap desalination or bacteria that eat plastics or whatever. So, it's completely crazy to suggest that we should carry on letting people suffer and die just for this completely spurious reason. And there's all the other things that people come up with, won't dictators live forever? Last I checked, dictator was fairly high on the league table of risky jobs. The inanity of these excuses for aging that people make. This is why I came up with the term the pro-aging trance, because people will say with a straight face things that a five-year-old will be embarrassed to say in the context of any other topic. So the thing is, then, what are the best answers? Of course, I've given one. I've said, this is not about longevity. This is about health. Hands up anyone who actually wants to get sick when they get old. Things like that. And also, of course, the simple fact that since we don't know whether any of these problems are going to arise, we certainly can make very good arguments that they won't, but even if we thought they would, 20, 30 years from now, it may be discovered that indeed they haven't arisen, and yet the therapies won't exist unless we've developed them, so we will be condemning a cohort of future humanity to an unnecessarily painful and unnecessarily early death just because we thought we knew better, and obviously that is morally reprehensible.
So what are the downsides then? Because I think if most people listen to you and your very persuasive argument that nobody wants to get ill, nobody wants to get old, nobody wants to die. What are the downsides of some of the technologies? I mean, we've seen the use of CRISPR or gene editing used in China and criticism for that. Some of the stuff you've spoken about before in terms of cellular rejuvenation and in cancer is another double-edged sword. What are some of the concerns that are legitimate in your view?
There aren't any. The concerns that you've just touched on are only concerns about the transition, about the development of new technology. All new medicine, all new technology has inherent risks that are only, one does one's best to identify them before the technology gets released in the wild, so to speak, but one can only do that up to a point, so one has to carry on, improving things, whether it's recalling a car because something broke in the manufacturing, whether it's, approving a medicine because it turned out to be more harmful than people knew beforehand. These things happen in any area of technology, including medicine, and if we were so risk averse that we said, we mustn't allow these risks to be taken, then no progress would ever be made. So I think it's complete nonsense to suggest that this constitutes an actual downside.
AI has obviously been around for a long time, but it feels like we've just recently crossed over into the mainstream consciousness. With your experience of AI and the field in general, how excited are you that we could see an acceleration in the progress through using some of these emerging technologies?
Well, certainly artificial intelligence is already being used in medical research, and it's working out pretty well. The most conspicuous example is surely the program called AlphaFold, which was generated by DeepMind over the past few years, and which has What it does is it predicts the three-dimensional structure of a protein based on its amino acid sequence. This is a classic problem that's existed for decades in medical research, and now that we can basically do that, pretty much the whole of medical research will go a lot faster. It's got an impact certainly comparable to that of the sequencing of the human genome 20 years ago. But there are plenty of other things to do with drug discovery and indeed drug repurposing where AI is proving to be very effective, and that certainly applies to longevity research, same as it does across medicine.
The human body is still very much an enigma in terms of how it works and how different genes are interacting, and it's going to be almost impossible to ever get a complete handbook to how the human body works. Is this something that where AI can play a role in terms of how all of our systems are interacting? Because you've spoken before about how it's not just a case of editing a gene, because we don't know the repercussions or the impact on other genes. What's your view on this and the potential breakthroughs there?
Yes, certainly the way that AI works is, pattern matching, really. It looks at data and it figures out what might be going on, and it's got ways to do that that are beyond human capabilities. So, this is why something like AlphaFold was possible. So absolutely, we certainly expect that would be the case. But of course, a huge amount of the difficulty in medical research, and certainly in longevity research, is that not only are we deeply ignorant about how the body works, we're also deeply incapable of actually looking at how the body works. The measurements that we have of, what's going on inside the body are extremely incomplete. We can take samples of the blood, and, for example, there are masses, thousands of metabolites of small molecules in the blood at low concentrations, but, concentrations that might change with age, whose function and role in the body we had no idea of. That's the kind of thing where I would expect that there might be contribution from AI in the relatively near future, simply because we can take a lot of blood samples from a lot of people and we can figure out correlations and AI may be able to see patterns. But if we go beyond the blood, if we look at other tissues, like inside cells in our organs, we don't have that kind of level of access to the data, to what's going on. And, figuring out what's going on there, you can't do it unless you can give AI the data.
We've spoken about how there's a 50-50 chance of some of these breakthroughs coming within the next 12 to 15 years. It's obviously going to be adopted by governments if they can see the upside, the cost saving, all the benefits you've mentioned. What about healthcare? How can healthcare on a national level start preparing itself for this? Because we don't want to be in a situation where suddenly the technology exists, but maybe the entire infrastructure is still a decade, a generation behind. How do we square that circle?
Yeah, this is exactly what I was saying about the vital necessity to educate governments now, so that they have at least a few years to do the changes to the regulatory environment and, invest in infrastructure and training of medical personnel and all that. At the level of public attitudes, the biggest obstacle by far is the inherent suspicion that exists of preventative medicine. It's more a suspicion of medicine in general. Anything that's new, people know that it might have downsides because it hasn't been, thoroughly stress tested, so to speak. And these things happen. But when we come to preventative medicine, what that translates into is an overly pessimistic understanding of the risk-benefit ratio. Basically, people think, well, okay, here's this new medicine. People saying terribly good things about it, but the idea is to take it before you're sick. And if there's anything wrong, then it's going to make me sick when I wasn't sick. And so, they're going to say, well, since I'm not yet sick, I'm not going to go near the medicine. And there are very few exceptions, things that have got through the whole process and become big, big money spinners despite that. So statins are an example, of course, for high cholesterol, ACE inhibitors for high blood pressure. They're basically the only exceptions, and they got that way sideways. They basically started out being treatments, and then it just could, because of the right people being in the right place at the right time, they were able to nudge their way into a more preventative context. And of course, as time went on and there was more and more evidence of safety, that also helped. But that takes time by definition. So we've got to find some way to get the public more comfortable with preventative medicine, and then things will move much faster.
Is the answer to that moving towards a more personalized approach when people can have their DNA, their DNA, everything analyzed so you can have complete and utter confidence that the preventative medicine you're being recommended will work for you? Could that be the watershed moment?
Even not exactly. So the personalization aspect is extremely important. Unfortunately, it also means that very often things are much more expensive and more difficult to deal with. So, for example, stem cell therapy. There are two types of stem cell therapy. There's what's called autologous, which basically means they take cells out of the person, out of somebody, and they mess around with them, and then they put the cells back into the same person. And then there's allogeneic stem cell therapy, where you've got one donor, and you just use those cells for everybody. Allogeneic is, you know, clearly inferior in the sense that one's got to worry about immune rejection, cells get destroyed by the recipient immune system and so on, but it's far cheaper. And it's also easier to get regulatory approval because it's just one product. That's just one example. It goes across the board. So it's difficult, but you're absolutely right. It plays an enormous role. However, the key thing about preventative medicine is a bit different from that, because the issue here is we need something that's predictive. If you've got a lot of measurements of what's going on in your blood, as well as physiological and cognitive function and so on, great. But if you take a medicine, then maybe things will change. Concentrations of this or that thing will change in your blood, but you have to know that that's actually an indicator of how soon you're going to get sick. So in the case of high cholesterol, we know that, but we only know it now after a large number of years with a lot of people taking statins, for example.
And just circling back very quickly to the need to get government on board now, what is your understanding in how receptive they are being? Because in other conversations I've had, whenever it comes down to politicians, it's all about the next election cycle, and that's all that matters. They can't see past that for understandable reasons. This is such a big issue, though, that you would hope that there would be some foresight to realise the cost benefits and all the other benefits you've mentioned. How receptive are these government politicians to the message you're spreading?
Yeah, it's tough. And honestly, I'm not a politician myself. I'm not very politically, diplomatic. it kind of being a diplomat and being a heretic don't really go together. But luckily, there are plenty of people in my circle in the movement who very much do have those skills and who are interfacing very much more with the government. One shouldn't overstate this whole business about the short-termism, the next election and so on, because in most governmental systems, there are a lot of people who are in safe seats, who don't really have to worry at all about losing their seat as a result of something that they say or they support. And those are the people who, of course, are able to, who will listen more and who may get things done.
Collaboration is obviously a huge part of solving this puzzle. Again, nudging the needle, are you seeing greater collaboration between different disciplines in terms of moving forward? You've spoken before about knowledge gaps and things not being picked up because there isn't that communication or necessary understanding of related fields. Are you seeing encouraging signs that the collaboration is beginning to coalesce into more solution-based approaches?
I do, especially on the scientific side. So I've been running conferences for 20 years, and my conferences are distinctive in a number of ways, but possibly the most important thing is the sheer breadth of expertise that I bring in among speakers. Very often I'll invite a speaker and they'll say, hang on, why are you inviting me? I don't work on aging. And I'll have to explain to them how they fit in, right? But the conferences have always been a roaring success, largely because nobody comes to there, no speaker comes, who knows the material of more than maybe a quarter of the other speakers. So everyone loves it, collaborations get set up and so on. And of course, it's not just the speakers, it's also all the delegates, including people who don't necessarily have scientific training, but they've educated themselves. And of course, these conferences are still happening. My next one is coming up this August, 17th to 20th in Dublin. It's a great place to have this kind of conference where there's a lot of emphasis on the recreational aspect, on the informal interactions. So, I hope many people who are seeing this will register.
And I'll be sure to include the relevant information. Just wanted to do a couple more questions in terms of, I'm really conscious I've asked you questions you've been answering for so long, and I don't want to do that. I want to try and find out, you know, what is coming next. So, Aubrey, what are the questions you wish journalists put to you? Where are we missing the bigger picture or the really important stuff that we're not picking up just because it's not our field of expertise?
Yeah, honestly, I don't think that's the problem. You know, when you've done interviews for a few years, it doesn't really matter what questions you get asked. You give the answers you want to give anyway, right? So, so that's not really the problem. The issue is, of course, you know, what the impact is on the audience. So, of course, you know, as I mentioned, my organization is a charity. And, of course, that means that on the one hand, people can give us money and they get, you know, tax rebate. But on the other hand, they're not in a position to eventually get the money back as profits the way they would in the private sector. So it's always an enormous battle to bring enough money in to get the work done that needs to be done. And obviously we've got LEV Foundation. We have a nice big friendly donate button. But fact is, I spend a lot of my time talking to people, trying to get them to understand that this is a really good use of their money. And so, of course, the main question I want people to ask is, where do I write the check, right?
What is your typical reaction when you speak to people on the street and you tell them some of the things you've told me today about what's coming down the pipeline? Do you get a kind of blank stare? People think it's science fiction, or do you find that there's almost a lightning bolt where they begin to see that what we're talking about is just around the corner and it's going to profoundly change everything we think we know about life and the world?
Yeah, so of course, again, there's a huge spectrum there. You know, if I talk to a typical audience, some of them will get it immediately, some of them won't. There's been a couple of times when I've been able to actually do the before and after experiment. In other words, either the person who's running some session will, you know, will do a poll at the beginning of, you know, do you want this guy to succeed in his mission? And at the end, when I've given my talk, do it again and see what's changed. And I'm generally quite heartened by the results of such things. You know, generally, maybe even as much as 10% of the audience will admit that they have changed their mind. Now, of course, what we don't know is whether they'll wake up the following day and it was all a bad dream and they get on doing, you know, what they were doing anyway. But, you know, all I can do is my best in this regard in trying to get the message through. And as I think I mentioned earlier, you know, what has happened over the past decade is people increasingly coming along who say broadly what I say, but say it in different language, you know, say it in a manner that resonates with different kinds of people. That diversity of messaging is absolutely essential, and the more we have of that, the better.
Thank you for listening to the Unfiltered podcast. If you've got this far, I hope you won't mind if I ask you to leave a 5-star review when you get the chance. We'd really appreciate it. And don't forget you can access all of our exclusive Unfiltered video interviews and features at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. See you next time.